is May 30th, and this is Start Me Up. I'm Kimberly, and hey, Steph.
Hi, Kimberly.
We're all excited today because we have Molly John Foss here. You keep giggling. Why?
I'm excited.
I know.
Because I'm so excited.
We've been waiting to talk to Molly. We had to cancel on her. And but before we begin, I just want to tell everybody that we'd love it if you supported the show. You could do it for $1 a month. You could do $5 and you get to listen to the And Another Thing segment, which airs directly after this. And that's Steph and I usually talking about private stuff. Or not too private, but a little private. And it's
fun. Yeah, sometimes too private.
Yeah, and we get a little raunchy. Anyway, so that's for $5, or you could just pledge anything you want. If you want to pledge $100, that would be awesome. Or $10 or $15, anything you want. We're independent, and we would appreciate your support. You can do that at patreon.com/startmeup. So, now, we're going to get to the good stuff. We've got Molly Jong Fast here. She is a hilarious feminist author and a Twitter goddess. Yeah. Hello, Molly.
Hi. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we're totally happy to have you. We've been looking forward to this for quite some time. So you're the author of The Social Climber's Handbook, Girl Maladjusted, True Stories from a Semi-Celebrity Childhood, and Normal Girl.
Yeah.
Have I covered all your books?
Yeah, I wrote a novel when I was in my late teens because I didn't want to go back to college.
Oh my God, there's a good reason.
And well, my mother was like, I came from this family of like very, you know, everybody, or my grandparents didn't go to college because they were immigrants. Well, they weren't immigrants. They were born in this country, but you know, it was a different time. They didn't go actually one of my grandparents did go to college, but most of them didn't, but my grandfather had a rule that all his daughters needed to have advanced degrees. So, and that never worked. One of them dropped out. Another one dropped out and then came back. But my mother did end up being ABD, everything but her dissertation. But she, her dissertation, she ended up, you know, whatever, writing. But so I dropped out of college, and it was like literally like a stab through the heart. Erica Jong. Like, she had I feel like I could have done, you know, she was just devastated. So, and I really didn't want to go back to college because I only had like 3 course credits. Like, I'd been to college for years, but I had been just like screwing around and not doing anything. So, I had like no course credits. So, I was like, if I sort of did the math in my head, and I was like, if I write a book, it'll be less time than going back to college. So, I did that. And I got it published also because I was so young. There was like a lot of novelty in that.
Right. Yeah.
And then I actually think, I haven't read it in a long time, but I actually think for what it was actually quite an interesting book. I wouldn't say that I'm like a check off or anything, but like, you know, it was an interesting book about getting sober as a teenager, which actually sold shockingly like a lot of copies. I think some of it was because people do get sober as teenagers, and there isn't a ton of literature about it. And I've actually stayed sober since I was a teenager, which is even more unusual.
For sure.
But it's interesting. And so I had this very interesting experience. So then I had this book, and I still hadn't finished college. So I actually went to this really cool program. I did an MFA at Bennington, and the head of the program had been my husband's poetry teacher at boarding school.
Wow.
And which was just like a weird coincidence. And I had like had children very young, not totally thought out. It ended up being amazing, but not completely planned. And, or as we say in the real world, not planned at all. And so I had this experience of like going back to college and doing an MFA, and it ended up being great for me.
Wow. Well, you mentioned your name before you ask Stephanie. I just want to say you mentioned your mom, Erica Jong, who is the author of Fear of Flying.
Yes.
And so just making sure everybody knows that.
She, among other things, she would want you to talk about her oeuvre. You know, I think that like she would want you to talk about all the many other books she's written, which, you know, it's funny though, but you do, you know, you're only as known for your most famous stuff, which I guess it's good to be known for anything, right?
Well, for me, I think about, you know, I'm older, my mom and I are 19 years apart. So in 1973, when Fear of Flying came out, I have this vision of my very young mom sitting on the couch, legs crossed, very, you know, exquisitely with a cigarette going, and just turning the page like, sorry, kids, no, there will be no attention paid to you until I am done with this book. And damn it, with her purple crushed velvet hot pants on, she, like, you know, she was empowered. And that's kind of an overused word, but that book did it for a lot of women, lot of women who, like you said, you know, your grandparents were, it was a different time, and they didn't go to college. Well, my mom helped put my dad through college, right? That was her generation. So married at 19, typing the papers again with the cigarette lit and just going all night long, helping get her man through his master's and through all, you know, those were the sacrifices that she made. But I think, you know, your mom is as much as, like you said, she'd want to be known for her, for the whole catalog of amazing work that she put out, that Fear of Flying really did light a fire. And interestingly enough, I tried to get my 14-year-old son in to see Deadpool the other day, but I had to accompany him, and my 10-year-old, that wasn't going to happen. So she and I bought the tickets to Deadpool. I know, it's supposed to be great, but my daughter doesn't like to see organs in things like that, she said. So we walked across the hall and went and saw a book club. Yeah. Do you know about this?
No, I know my mom saw it. There's a lot of Erica Jong in book club.
Well, the whole thing is Erica Jong. That's what the whole movie was founded on. These four kick-ass women in their 20s read Fear of Flying. They created a book club. It was the first book they read, and it kind of set the stage for one who becomes a federal judge, one who owns a hotel. I mean, and there it's Jane Fonda, Candace Bergen, Mary Steenburgen.
I'm really
excited. It's awesome. But your mom's book, like, this is what it did for women. Mm-hmm. And then it's no surprise that you're a product of her, because you kill me on a daily basis, multiple times a day with your just in your face tweets. And they're, you're so damn witty, which is, it's fun. And I enjoy you.
Well, what's amazing about Twitter. Sorry, go on.
You go on.
I think a lot about Twitter. Like, I think about it a lot because I am sort of addicted to it, but I also think about what does it mean? Like, what is it? You know, my husband and I are both really addicted to it. I'm much more addicted to it because he is a venture capitalist, so he has to, like, actually, like, work. And also, he travels. He can't really, and he has a real, you know, world life, whereas I don't. So, but what's interesting to me about Twitter is, first of all, it's completely changed the way that I read news. Mm-hmm. Because I can say, and even we were talking about this the other day, like, you know, years ago, the New York Times would write something you didn't agree with, you'd send a letter, they'd never print it, period, paragraph, like, it's over. And here you can, like, literally say, no, Maggie Haberman, that's not right. Like,
yep.
And it's sort of awful for journalists in a weird way. Like, I think of this, you know, because I grew up in a family of, academics and artists, I always think of, it's so important, journalism, and especially right now, is like the most important time ever to have journalists, and the most important time ever to protect them. Mm-hmm. So it's ironic that this form of this medium is obviously terrible for them in certain ways, because their work gets stolen, you know, they're being questioned all the time by people who have almost no, you know, who put their hand on a rock and say they're, you know, an authority. But in the same sense, it is like an incredibly empowering time for the media consumer in a way that has never been, which is kind of amazing. And, you know, for me, I grew up very privileged. And so I was like not used to the idea of being disempowered. You know, I grew up with, you know, if I wanted something, I did it, you know, and I felt like I could pretty much do anything. And I used to actually one of the things I really regret was in my 20s, I used to always say, you know, feminism, it's not really necessary anymore. Like, yes, it was necessary when you were young, but the world has changed, because I had no, and even like you see this, the people who write negative, the women who write negatively about the Me Too movement tend to be the women who are very privileged.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, absolutely.
And they don't know the experience of being a 23-year-old from Duluth where this is your only shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and so I feel like, in fact, actually the way that I discovered this was I was, you know, musing to my friend about Me Tooism, and I was saying, well, you know, I know it's a real thing, and I know it's important, and da-da-da-da-da, but you know, it never happened to me. And my friend was like, you never had a job. You came from a famous family. She was like, the person who did it to you would be an idiot.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what I mean? It's about the idea of, like, looking for people who don't have power and exploiting it. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think about, like, what Twitter has done is it's empowered a ton of us, you know, in an interesting and probably destructive way. So I think about it a lot.
Yeah, it's you know? I mean, I started on Facebook, and this was back in, I started my Facebook page in 2011, and I had just come out with my book, The Virgin Diaries, and I needed a platform and to talk about it. And then, long story short, I wrote a blog post to Rush Limbaugh saying, you know, something like open letter to Rush Limbaugh from a liberal slut, because he was calling Sandra Flick a slut. And that kind of like sparked my whole activism online. And I started writing political articles and I became political. And my whole goal for being online, at least on Facebook initially, was to promote myself as an author. And but nobody knew who the hell I was. And right. So going back to what you were saying, I think, I mean, obviously there's good and bad, but one of the things that I really enjoy about whether it's Twitter or Facebook, which Facebook less and less, but still,
right.
I've developed quite a following on Facebook too. So I still utilize that, but it's the kind of a thing where if you're an author or if you're an artist or if you're a political writer, whatever it is, you don't necessarily need somebody else who's got all the power to say, mm-hmm. all right, I'm going to say this person can write and this person
right,
can't.
Exactly.
Anybody can write. And then the public's going to decide. You either
exactly.
suck or you're going to grow. And so, you know, it's like, I mean, obviously get into the fake news and to the Russian interference. We need to have this all regulated. But I think Twitter's fucking amazing because it's an opportunity to interact. Like you were saying, you can speak directly to Maggie Haberman. You can speak directly to these people and have communications with them in such a personal way. And even if you're not really friendly or friend, you know this person personally, you have sometimes these Twitter relationships. Like, I mean,
exactly.
I think you and I have one. I mean, we've never met or anything, but we know each other via Twitter and we get each other's sense of humor. So, you know, and one of the things I just want to add about you, Molly, is something that I respect and not necessarily that I always do, but I think that I have a tendency, especially when I get pissed off, I just fucking tweet. And sometimes I'm a little bit crude. I see that you're more reserved and what I respect about you is that you have a little soft-spoken approach and you utilize humor where I'll just go, you're a fucking asshole. But I enjoy what you do because what you're able to do is you're able to convey what you want to say, but you use humor. And that's always really the best way to do it because if you can make people laugh, you have a much better chance of getting people to listen to you.
It's just another way to get people riled up and on board, though, because it's your humor is biting, your humor is intelligent, and it's you know, and Kimberly, you too, my God, I love it. When shit starts to hit the fan, that's what I look for first, or Kimberly's tweets, because I'm happy to be on that bandwagon. And thank God for people like you. Thank God for the Horse Whisperer. Thank God for Bob Seska.
You should interview the Horse Whisperer.
So
I want to.
How can
I talk to him. I'll ask him.
Okay.
We're in a DM room. He's great.
Okay, well then, all right, cool. Then,
But I mean, he's very, he's cagey.
He's cagey? Why?
He's cagey. Well, I don't know. But he's very, he doesn't want, you know, with these anonymous.
Right.
I'm friends with a bunch of anonymous people, and they tend, especially like the deep state Twitter, the like, those people, the anonymous accounts that are like alt-gov, those people are pretty careful, as well they should be.
Yeah,
you
they
know.
Should.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, what I think is interesting, too, about Twitter is that, you know, we have this power, but we need it. Like, when I got it, the reason I got on Twitter was because, you know, I would find that Hillary, actually, even before, during the election, before the election, like, you know, she would tweet, and there would be, like, these insane Twitter people who would say these, you know, she tweet this sort of very thoughtful, elegant, you know, thought-out idea that would have, you know, endless things to back it up, and they would say, like, you know, uranium won. It wasn't uranium that won back then, but they'd have some insane conspiracy theory. And, you know, you'd go down the rabbit hole, and there'd be hundreds of these. Now it turns out they were bot networks, but I remember thinking, like, this can't be, there can't be this many people who are this stupid and uninformed. You know, like, but I couldn't even believe it. I mean, there are, definitely, but there are also...
There's bots, yeah.
It's amplified.
Yeah, the bots... They're crazy.
Yeah.
I want to ask. Oh, go keep going. And then I want to ask you something about stupid people.
Yeah. No. Go on.
You know, because I do spend a lot of time on Twitter. I find that it's got to be all politics all the time for me right now because our democracy is in peril, and you know, children are being ripped out of the arms of their mothers when they're coming to seek asylum at the border. And, you know, I mean, the list goes on and on and on, and we live in a racist country. But really, we have a racist president who's making it okay for the 30% of this of the United States to just be stupid and on display at all times. And I wonder what you guys think about, you know, when this all ends, and I feel like... cautiously optimistic that we're coming, that this might be coming to a close soon. Like some, like maybe Mueller is close. Avenatti certainly is bringing stuff.
Did you see that with the tapes?
Yep, with the tapes. Oh lordy, there are tapes. It's all over the place, right? So we've got tapes.
Wait, I don't know what tapes. What tapes are you talking about?
Avenatti tweeted like 2 days ago that there are tapes.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, not 2 days ago, 20 minutes ago.
20
he,
minutes
he
ago.
He tweeted that there were tapes. I'm sorry, not 2 days ago.
No, it's okay.
It feels like 2 days ago, but it was 20 minutes ago.
But it was 20 minutes ago. It's like dog years. Like, who,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, really.
It's insane.
But it's insane.
But I would say the thing that's interesting about it is like, I don't know. I mean, it's like we're living through Watergate, except times a million.
Yeah.
Times a million.
And
people like just, you know, regular dumb, toothless civilians with red MAGA hats on are participating in this. And so what happens? I'm sorry, maybe they all have teeth. I don't know. That was wrong of me because I try to not name call.
Right.
And at some, you know, sometimes like just look at the people at the Tennessee rally last night. You know, like it's a predictable crowd. We know who's going to be in attendance, whether it's Indiana or Tennessee or whatever. What happens to those people when it's all over? Because it will be all over. It has to be. And so what happens to that 30% of America? Do they all have guns? Are they all just too lazy? And
I think we're worried. I mean, I think people are rightfully worried. You know, I think it's... I mean, that's the thing. I think that we're in this situation where we have this... president who's completely nuts, who will do anything to stay in power. He knows that Mueller has stuff he's going to make him look bad. You know, I mean, the thing that I was thinking about so much was, you know, I had a meal with Felix Sater, who's this crazy Russian mobster who is involved in Trump Russia, and who a very good writer called Anthony Cormier became Anthony Cormier's source, and Anthony Cormier has been writing these pieces for BuzzFeed about Felix Sater and his relationship with Donald Trump.
Right.
And Felix Sater is really his father was a mobster. He spent a year in jail for stabbing someone in the neck. You know, these are not the kind of people that most wealthy New York real estate investors hang out with. But what's so interesting with him, you know, I sat down and I said, okay, there's collusion, right? And he said, what? No collusion, no collusion. And I went to my friend Virginia Heffernan, who's a really great journalist and knows a lot about Trump and does a Trump cast for Slate Magazine. And I said to her, because she had brought him, I said, this guy's saying there's no collusion. I said, this is the most insane thing. I read that article on BuzzFeed. It's collusion. Mm-hmm. And she said, ask him what he thinks collusion means. Mm-hmm. And that was what I thought was interesting, is like these people in Trump world, they don't think a crime is a crime.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so ultimately, it's like the lie detector test for the sociopath. Like, they don't think they did anything wrong because they have no morality.
Right, and they don't think they're racist.
Right. So it comes down to this idea, you know, like Obama was spotless about his ethics because he knew that everyone was going to come after him, you know, for any number of reasons. And then we have this president for whom he just doesn't see ethics as a problem.
No.
And so I think it's very interesting to see what will happen when they have, you know, obviously there's going to be huge, huge stacks of evidence and data. And we've heard for months that, you know, members of the Senate have been going over to Langley to see stuff that would make your hair turn green, you know. Yeah. So the question is, I mean, it's like the least, I feel like it's the least well-kept secret in the world is that there's endless evidence against the guy. But, you know, he doesn't think that it's a big deal.
Well, yeah. And getting back to what you were saying, too, Steph, about, like, what's going to be. I mean, I think we need to rise up. I mean, we've got resistance and all of that. But, I mean, you know, we've seen a few things happen because of the resistance. We've seen healthcare being saved, at least for now.
Right.
We, you know, we've seen fights for net neutrality. I think
you should have. I just want to say last night in that rally, the Nuremberg style rally that Trump did.
Yeah.
I couldn't watch it.
In Nashville, he spent about 10 minutes getting the crowd to boo John McCain.
Right.
Who is dying.
Dying. Yes.
War hero.
Yeah.
Who gave his life for his country. I mean, I'm no John McCain. You know, I'm a Democrat and like, you know, but the thing is we've come to such a partisan place. Like, you know, I love Evan McMullen. I don't know if you guys know who he is.
Love
him, right? He ran for president. He's just a very good person who really believes in, he's a patriot. And people, I'll retweet him and people will be like, he's not pro-choice. And I'm like, he's not a Democrat. Like, we can respect people who are not in our party. And that is like the worst legacy of Trumpism, I think, is that we can't say, you know, there will be no good government until the left and the right can agree on certain things. And like prison reform is a no-brainer. Like the left and the right really agree on certain aspects of prison reform. And like there are so many places where, and that's why I feel like the only answer to not having a civil war is to be able to reach out to the right. Because the reality is like Trump picked up on a kind of disenfranchisement that was there. You know, he wouldn't have risen to power. It's like Hitler. Hitler didn't rise to power because people were happy and well-adjusted.
Yeah,
right.
You know, he rose to power because they were on the streets. And, like, Trump didn't rise to power because he was, like, you know, a great, smart, brilliant leader. He rose to power because these people saw their jobs go away and got and blamed immigrants.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Right, and they blamed the black president.
That's right. Right.
And then you also, I mean, I think that first of all, in order to heal this, we have to get Congress to turn, and then Congress has to work on, you know, ways to keep this from happening again. I also think that with what's happening right now, I mean, we've got this big resistance, and we the people are the ones who are going to have to decide right now. We're only going to have one shot to repair what's happening,
right.
And we can't allow Russia to continue to do what it's doing. We need stuff in place that's going to save us from that. We need, whether it's regulating the internet or, you know, to make sure that the fake news doesn't go off. But this has been going on for a really long time. There's this fabulous book by this woman called, Claire, I have to look it up. It's called Wrapped in the Flag. And her father was one of the founding members of the John Birch Society.
Right.
And was friends with Fred Koch, I believe, Daddy Koch, who was also one of the founding members. And so she writes about growing up with a father in the John Birch Society, and then basically it's the Tea Party. So it's never gone away. It kind of lost power for a while. You know, it's like the moral majority and all of that, but they didn't have political power. They got political power in 2010 with the midterm elections, and they called themselves the Tea Party. It's the same right. stuff. And yeah. so this has been, you know, and then you add that to Fox and the toxic radio, Rush Limbaugh types and InfoWars and all of that. And you've got this perfect storm, like you were saying, Trump rose to power because people are angry. Well, it's like this whole long thing. I mean, I don't know how we're ever going to get rid of, you know, the toxic radio. I don't know about Fox.
I mean,
because
there's
not even a centralized idea of truth anymore.
That was right. Rush Limbaugh's legacy. You know, he was the person who started us on this path. You know, the Rushes and the, you know, there are so many people like that. I mean, I think what will happen, I mean, the good thing is that, you know, in Eric Greitens, you know, yes. he just stepped down yesterday. Yeah. And, like, Eric Greitens is a great example of someone who, I mean, basically his crimes are Trumpian, mm-hmm. you know. He misused information, perfectly Trumpian. He, you know, may have sexually harassed his mistress, very Trumpian. You know, revenge porn, very Trumpian, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And he had to step down. So that gives me some hope that there is, that maybe the Trumpian principles cannot be transferred. And even if you look at Blankenship, he didn't win his primary. And if you look at Roy Moore, like, he got a Democrat elected in Alabama,
yeah.
you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
hello,
yeah.
Right, you know.
Right,
so
right.
So you have to wonder if Trumpism just doesn't work for people who aren't Trump, and that I think will be a larger question.
That's
we'll see
it,
that in
yeah.
the midterms. You know, we'll see that with the Michael Grimes.
Just like
we'll
Roseanne.
See that, right? With I mean, what with Roseanne? I think it's a little bit different because I think what's happening with Roseanne is corporations trying to step in. And govern for the because our government is a black hole, mm-hmm. because our mm-hmm. president doesn't legislate in any discernible way, we have this interesting situation of corporations, you know, as someone who's married to a venture capitalist, you know, racism is bad for business. It's actually
yeah, it
bad
is.
For business. And, like, not having health care for employees is bad for, mm-hmm. you know, certain ideals of Democrats are actually very good for capitalism. So you see these corporations like Starbucks trying desperately to fill the void. I mean, we'll see what happens. This move from ABC was an incredible move. Like,
yeah.
uh-huh. it was very meaningful. And if you look at it compared to what happened with the NHL, mm-hmm. it's a great advance. Now, what's interesting to me about the NHL is that one of these NHL leaders, who actually is the brother of a very big Republican donor, such a big Republican donor that he's actually now the ambassador, a European ambassador, he said he would pay the fine for the...
oh, interesting. Yeah.
Right. For the, you know, the players who kneel. And I thought that was really interesting because that, again, and he's a Republican, you know, again, that's that idea that the government isn't working right now. And so the people are going to step in. And it's interesting. I don't know what it means.
Yeah, it's really scary because we have to change it ourselves.
Yeah.
We do have to change it ourselves. And I think people, you know, it becomes, it's not partisan. This is, freedom belongs to everybody. And that's why we're all here. And when it comes down to, you know, freedom of speech or following the Constitution, I'm glad that this Republican owner said, screw it, I'll pay for these football players who are kneeling because they're exercising their freedom.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what's going to save us, honestly. It's people coming together.
The interesting thing to me, too, about this kneeling thing, you know, they picked kneeling because it was very respectful. I mean, that's
right.
the joke.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, meanwhile, Roseanne, like, grabbed her crotch and spat.
Yeah.
When she's
yeah.
saying that, you know, I mean, it's just so ironic that they're being punished for being black and Roseanne is being, you know, exonerated for being a racist.
Exactly.
You know, mm-hmm. it's like upside down world. But I will say today to have Trey Gowdy, mm-hmm. Mr.
Yes.
Benghazi, you
mm-hmm.
know, saying that, you know, that the FBI was right to investigate the spies in the, you know, there are no spies in the campaign. And
right,
that,
right.
they were right to investigate the campaign's, you know, many, many connections to Russia. I thought that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, yep. And then Bob and I have a son named Robert Costa who writes for Washington Post.
Oh yeah, I know.
We call him Muggsy. That's our son. And anyway, he tweeted, slight cracks in the GOP Trump bond. House GOP moderates break from party's hard line on immigration. Then Gowdy goes on Fox and defends FBI's use of informants. And I'm never going to say this right. Napolitano adds, yeah. It's likely standard operation procedure in intelligence gathering. So, maybe we're going to see some more GOP cracking, but it's just they're so afraid of Trump's base, and that's the problem.
Yeah.
We just cannot let that minority, because they're not a complete minority, but they are a minority. I mean, there's more of us. We can't let them win.
But you know what's going to be really interesting? The base is very, you know, nutty and racist and loves Roy Moore, but they need more than the base to win.
Yeah.
So they have to be Trumpier than Trump in their primaries and then normal to win the seats.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see if that seems like an impossible equation.
Yeah, that's like that guy, it was that guy, the Cocaine Mitch guy.
Cocaine Mitch is, that's Don Blankenship. And Don Blankenship may run as an independent.
Yeah.
And I pray that he does. Because he's just comical.
Comical.
No. Yeah. It's so
holding
pathetic,
the kids.
Though.
Cocaine Mitch. China people. I literally.
China. His China family.
China
Cocaine
people.
Mitch and his China family.
And, go
the
ahead.
The punchline for Cocaine Mitch is you know where he lives.
Where? What?
West Virginia, otherwise known as Las Vegas.
Oh.
He doesn't even live in West Virginia. I'm like, way to go.
West Virginia, yeah. It's pretty crazy. I don't, you're right. Getting back to the impossible equation, there's no way, and it hasn't worked for him yet.
No.
Okay? Having the Trumpier than Trumps. And I was in Virginia right before Halloween, right before the special election when Ralph Northam won. And we have my husband has family in Virginia, and the 80-something-year-old aunts who voted for Trump, even though I begged them not to, because my kids are one quarter Mexican because of me, and I said, now Aunt Angela, come on, you can't do that to your one quarter Mexican sweet niece and nephew, and she's like, oh Stephanie, don't you do that. Well, those two 80-somethings approached us 2 days before that special election and said, we are mortified that we supported this man and that he is in the White House right now. What do we do? And my response was, you vote all the way up and down that ballot Democrat. That's how you fix it. And and I think they did, because look at the result. But the midterms that are coming up here, I think one of the things that we have that I don't want to call it an ace in the hole by any stretch, but look at all the kids who have turned 18 and who will be 18 by November. They haven't been really factored into the equation thus far. We're still operating off of this 30% of the population that voted is the base. Now we got the 18-year-olds who, they're like dogs on your pant leg. You know, you ain't kicking them off for nothing. And
yeah,
I think
we'll
they could,
them
I think they could truly change.
Yeah.
I think they could change the outcome. And I think they could single-handedly take us to victory in November.
Molly, what do you think?
By us, I mean sane people.
Right.
Molly, what do you think of the midterms? Like, what are you expecting?
I mean, I think the X factor that no one knows about is the Russia interference.
Yes.
Like, we don't know how much, realistically, we don't know how much Russia interfered. You know, I've heard they didn't change the vote tally. I don't know. So I'm a little bit worried. And my biggest worry is like how much Russia will interfere, how much they'll be allowed to interfere.
Yeah.
What I'm not, a lot of their candidates are really terrible. And a lot of our candidates are really great. So that is good news. The Senate map is really scary.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of really good candidates. Like I'm involved in this thing called the Arena Summit. And we have a PSC for a bunch of really good candidates. And we have like a candidate in named Dan McCready, who I love. He got more votes in his primary than the Republican challenger or the Republican incumbent or any of the other. You know, he got more votes than anyone. Hmm. And his incumbent actually got defeated in the primary by a Bannon candidate. So that was very cool to see. And he's like an incredible, you know, he's a war veteran. He's an, you know, an entrepreneur. He has four kids. He's just like, a, I mean, the thing is, there are really great, smart people who would never have considered running for office, but are so horrified by Trumpism that they're doing it. And I just read an article that literally was just published like 2 hours ago on the Daily Beast about why, you know, about Eric Greitens and why the people who are sort of criminals tend to want to run for office. Mm-hmm. You know, people who have these kind of very narcissistic and dangerous personalities. And so these people who are running because of Trumpism are not those people. They're people who are just really altruistic and really terrified. I mean, we have a candidate, Lauren Underwood, black nurse who worked in the Obama administration doing public health, who's unbelievable. And the truth is, she would never have run for Congress if it weren't for Trumpism, because why would she? You know, she's got a master's of public health. She's a genius. Like, she should be working in the private sector and raking it in. But the reality is, like, she knows how fragile our democracy is. So I think that the candidates we have in the Democratic Party, a lot of them are pretty incredible. So I think we don't know what Russia's going to do. But I think we are in some, we got some real good races in the on the Democratic side. On the congressional side, for the Senate, it's really scary and sketchy. You know, we have to defend a lot of seats in a lot of places where Trump won. I don't know how it's going
to
play out.
I think it's going to be a harder deal for us to handle the Russian interference. Well, it'll just depend on what happens in the midterms, because hopefully if we do get enough people in, laws can be written and enforced. But, you know, it's easier for the Russians to interfere with a general election than it is with all these. And what gives me hope about that is looking at the recent wins we've experienced with, you know, Virginia and New Jersey and Alabama and all of that. So, you know, and as Stephanie pointed out, not only in 2020, I mean, in 2018, we're going to have all the kids who've turned 18 and are ready to vote. But then by 2020, we're getting an additional amount of young people who are going to be of age, and hopefully they're going to take the cue from, you know, the David Hoggs and all the rest of them and join in. Because, you know, whether or not, I mean, I don't know, like you said, I don't know if these votes were literally changed. Minds were changed.
Right.
But we can with these, with, you know, now that we understand it, at the time, we didn't know what was happening. I didn't, you know, I was certainly clueless as to what was going on. And I was supporting Bernie in the primary. I supported Hillary in the general. And I just liked the platform. I like the idea of turning this into a more progressive country. And that was why I supported him in the primary. But now I, you know, looking back, and I've said this before, I've talked about this at length, so I won't go into it, you know, a lot. But just I saw in front of my eyes, these Bernie groups went from really nice people being polite to each other and not bashing on Hillary to, you know, pit fucking holes in hell, all bashing Hillary and lies. And it was just so horrible. So I think that we're a little bit more savvy now, because it's like, oh, okay, I fell for it. I mean, I didn't fall for it to where I hated her. I just saw this shit happening. And I saw weird things happening with voter registrations. People were complaining that they, you know, they had registered as Democrats and then it was back to Republican or whatever, so they couldn't vote. And I believe that could have been the Russian interference.
I mean, Jill Stein, too.
Oh, yes.
Definitely.
I never liked her. She fucking blocked me on Twitter.
And me too. And she's like a good case for why this is like Russia definitely got involved in the far left. I mean, I actually think the Bernie situation is more complicated. And my husband would like disagree with me. We have fights about this all the time because I loved Hillary. But I also think really that she was like a candidate that people didn't find compelling. So. Yeah. What happened with that is when you're a candidate that people don't find compelling, I didn't love Bernie, but the reality was Bernie, people got very excited about Bernie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people found him compelling. He did not speak to me, but his supporters were much more enthusiastic than Hillary's supporters. So you had this disconnect. Mm-hmm. And I think that the reason that they were able to turn some of those people, the Trump people, was because they were so angry at the Democratic Party and they didn't connect to Hillary. And, you know, I think, you know, he won this presidency because of a number of factors.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it was absolutely. It was like you were saying, I mean, the GOP can only handle so much. He mm-hmm. wouldn't have won without Russian help. So,
oh, yeah.
And that's, you know, looking at, talking about these midterms, it's like, I'm a little bit less worried, although I'm still worried. I'm a little bit less worried about the midterms and Russian interference. I'm more worried about 2020. But again, I think the majority of that was minds changed. And, you know, my mind wasn't changed. And as far as Hillary's concerned, you know, I think that this smear campaign that's been, you know, all about her by the GOP for decades, it's definitely soured people's opinions of her when she runs for president, because when she was the Secretary of State, everybody loved her. When she was a senator, everybody loved her. Well, not the Republicans. They had Benghazi trials forever.
Right.
But she was very popular. And then when she decided she wanted to run for president, you know, things changed. And then, again, it's the smear campaign and it's all the shit coming out and fake bullshit stories. And then, you know, you're just... Most people, when they're scrolling through or listening to the news and they hear these horrible things, whether it's true or not, it gets stuck in your head. And then it doesn't help when MSNBC, I mean, right. MSNBC has got like Trump 24/7.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, yeah I mean, during the campaign season, he was the one that got ratings.
Right.
And
he
everybody
got
wanted
to
pay attention
Absolutely.
To Trump. And it's like, you know, Hillary and all the rest of them were kind of by the wayside. I mean, there was this one time when I think Hillary was actually speaking or something, and they were just filming like Trump's empty podium waiting for him to come. Completely
right. No,
ignoring her.
I mean, I do think also, you know, this is true. This is how people do, you know, people who aren't great speakers don't win.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
And if you look at like, if you look at Hillary, Hillary is so much like John Kerry and so much like, you know, Dukakis and so much like Mitt Romney. She's like very smart and very educated, but she's not a charismatic speaker. And, you know, if you look at Al Gore, she's the same as those people.
Yeah.
And if you look at Trump, he's more of a Bush too, you know, who was like, you know, you knew Bush, too, didn't know what he was talking about, but you liked the way he said it.
Yeah, it's
and
true.
And if we don't run people like that, we won't win.
Yeah, no, we like, definitely have to get charismatic people, unfortunately, you know, because Hillary's strength, and she admitted it on the campaign trail. She's like, okay, my husband's got the gift. I don't. I'm just not that kind of a political animal.
Well, then you can't run for president.
Exactly.
Her strength, though,
You're
was
right.
actually doing the work. You know,
right.
and unfortunately, we're not focusing on that. We're looking at how great, you know, somebody can get
a
crowd
riled up. I mean, that's just not a good. I mean, it is good. It's wonderful, but it's not a. It ain't the way to get to be president.
Yeah,
no.
You know? I know. We need.
So.
Oh, okay. So we're gonna have to wrap up. But I just wanted to ask you, Molly. Are you working anything? Working on?
Yeah,
anything
I'm working
new?
On a novel, and I'm writing different stuff about politics, and you know, I'm tweeting constantly. Endlessly. You know, I just want to mention one of my favorite candidates that I'm the most excited about.
Please.
Is Stacey Newman from Atlanta, who's from Georgia, who's running for governor.
Yes.
Abrams.
She's awesome.
Abrams.
Yes.
Yeah. She's a black woman.
That is so incredibly exciting.
Yeah. And she's not just, sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to go back because I said she's a black woman. She's not just a black woman. You know, I heard her speak at this Emily's List event, and she is like, she was the head of the minority party in her state when she was in the state government.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked about how she was able to get libertarians to support environmental reforms.
Hmm.
Because,
amazing.
And she's just very brilliant and thoughtful. And I was so impressed with her, and I just think she's an incredible candidate, and the fact that she's gotten this far gives me hope.
And Rachel had wonderful things to say about her too, Maddow.
Yeah.
And she speaks
amazing.
Well. You know what, Molly, I wanna just really quickly address the, you know, if you're not a great speaker, you shouldn't be running for president. You can be a worker, you can be brilliant, you could be an amazing Secretary of State or Senator, right?
Right.
But it's people like Stacey Abrams.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's
great. who can connect. You know, Barack Obama was very, very special in that when he spoke, you felt like he was talking to you and it was relatable. And yet he was serious, he was earnest, but he had a sense of humor. Kids liked him. I mean, he was the complete package. Yeah. I want a woman, and I'm ready. America is ready for a woman because I think there will be less wars. I think there's going to be a lot more empathy. There's no empathy now in that office. But, you know, we need people who can connect, who can speak, and who can engage on that human level, like a Stacey Abrams. You know, not necessarily an Eric Holder. Yeah, he's brilliant, but he doesn't make me swoon when he speaks, you know?
Unfortunately,
neither does Kamala. But that's a whole other conversation, and maybe another visit by you. We can vet candidates.
Yeah, exactly. Love you to come back.
Yeah, no, I would love to, and I'd love to talk about the, you know, as we get, there's just going to be so much interesting stuff. I can't believe it's like a news tsunami.
I know.
Every minute. It's like dog years. We're living fucking dog years.
Bob calls it the fire hose of news, yeah.
I know. Thanks for doing this four-hour podcast with us, Molly.
I'm honored to be involved.
Well, it was good to have you.
And everybody thank you for having me.
Yes, and everybody can follow you at Molly Jong Fast. It's at Molly Jong Fast. And it's J-O-N-G.
Yeah, like Kim Jong and not like Carl Gustav Jung.
Right.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for coming on today, and we're definitely going to have you back. And
thank you for having me. I'm honored. Thank you.
Well, good luck. I can't wait to see the new book.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you.
That'll be cool. All righty.
Awesome. All right. Thanks.
Thanks, Molly.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow. She's pretty cool, huh?
She's pretty damn cool. You know, from college dropout to teen sobriety writer to MFA from Bennington.
Yeah, okay. I know. Well, you know what? I stopped when she was saying that. I forgot to say something, but it made me laugh because I'm writing my new book right now, and I dropped out of college, and I decided that I was going to be in commercials and music videos.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I dropped out of college. And I told my dad, he was just like, my father is all about security, job security. And, you know, just he, that was not good news for him. I can only imagine how he must have felt when my, you know, like what, 20 something year old self said, I'm not going to go to college anymore. I'm going to star in music videos and commercials, which by the way, I never did. So
yeah, but you were a cop on a very popular soap opera. I was. I've seen you in that, and you wore that uniform well, my dear. I'd have obeyed you. Yeah, you know what? We all do. We all do things, and we get to where we are. You know, I was trying to tell. I'm sure you have no regrets.
No,
do you have
any
regrets?
No,
exactly.
I have no regrets.
Exactly. Look at where this path that you took led you to, you know, being with Bob and being the father of Robert Costa and all of these wonderful things. You know, you can't ignore your path.
I'm the father of Robert Costa.
I mean, the mother. Excuse me. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. That was a slip.
Muggsy's my son.
Muggsy.
I love Muggsy.
He's so cute, Muggsy.
he's a little thin now.
I love him. I love him in all forms and shapes.
I know. I love him too. He's fucking awesome. All right. So we're going to head on over to end another thing. So don't forget, you can support our little independent show by becoming a monthly subscriber at patreon.com/startmeup. Any amount is appreciated. $5 gets you into our next segment.
And that's right.
We'll be talking about, I don't know, some nasty stuff probably.
Oh, I love the 80s. Thank you so much, by the way.
See you on the other side.
All right.